C-K-U-T.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing.
On.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize?
Our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour. Today is November 20th. My name is Brian Isaac, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Kanyetkahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
C is for
cauliflower,
confusion, creation,
pickle, K is for
kitten,
camp,
seat, wait, sunroof, U, unbearable,
U is for underground,
oh, yeah,
umbrella,
T, trite,
tremendous,
torment,
tire,
C, K,
I can't think of a U one,
T,
F is for famous,
fun, fumble, M is for Montreal.
Welcome back to CKUT, I'm Brian. This week, community advocates gathered in Villeray to support the naturalization of Mamadou Konaté. Mamadou worked as a healthcare worker in a long-term care home, but because he's not a citizen, he's still facing deportation. Community supporters want government officials to halt his deportation sentence. The provincial government announced yesterday that Christmas gatherings are on. Premier Legault says gatherings of up to 10 people are allowed during 4 specific days in December. High school holiday break will also be extended by 1 week. As of Thursday, November 19th, Quebec is reporting 1,207 new COVID-19 cases. And November 20th marks Transgender Day of Remembrance. It's an annual commemoration of the lives and contributions of transgender people.
CKUT is going online for our 2020 annual general meeting. Join us on Monday, November 23rd at 6 p.m. to hear how your favorite community radio station has been adapting to the current pandemic by broadcasting remotely. To find out how you can get involved in one of our various committees, to propose a motion, or find out more information about joining our Board of Governors, email culture@ckut.ca. That's culture@ckut.ca. Monday, November 23rd at 6 p.m. online, CKUT's annual general meeting. To RSVP for the event, email agm@ckut.ca. That's agm@ckut.ca. Hope to see you there.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. Because of the pandemic, CKUT is operating remotely. This means that programming will be a mix of news, podcasts, and longer forms of audio. Today, we'll be running a November 15th podcast from Final Straw Radio. It's about housing rights, eviction, and COVID-19.
Airing first on Asheville FM, this is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist, anti-authoritarian radio show broadcasting from occupied Soligee land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from people, projects, and struggles around the world engaging in the long project toward liberation. You can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net or at protonmail.com, or send us letters at P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina 28816. This week, I got the chance to sit down with Olive and Yusuf of the Durham, NC-based eviction defense group Heads Up. Heads Up stands for Housing Eviction Defense Solidarity, and is a group which formed in Durham, North Carolina when COVID was first hitting the area and folks' housing was becoming more and more unstable. We get to talk about a lot of topics in this episode, among which are gentrification in Durham, what the North Carolina eviction process might look like, and about the group's handbook, the Eviction Defense Handbook, Volume 1312, which can be found on their website, can'tpaywon'tpaydurm.org. This handbook is extensively written and researched and was put together by Heads Up for educational and empowerment purposes. It covers topics from abolition to how one might structure an eviction defense team, pertinent information regarding COVID and evictions, how to look up information on a specific property, a step-by-step of what to expect in eviction court, and many more topics.
The Final Straw Radio is a proud member of the Channel Zero network of anarchist podcasts, and here's a jingle from another member of CZN.
I'm Kami.
And I'm Franz, and together we are co-hosts of the Doomer vs. Bloomer podcast on the Channel Zero network.
Every week I'm going to complain about how the world is fucked, things are definitely going to get worse before they get better, and we're all probably going to die.
And I disagree with Kami and think that having hope is important. We can make things better, but only if we believe we can and put in all the effort we're able to into organizing against capitalism in the state.
Yeah, we'll see.
That's the core of our podcast, y'all. It's our shtick. We disagree.
Find our show on SoundCloud or wherever you find podcasts, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Doomer v. Bloomer.
And here are a few announcements we'd like to share. First up, the Wabanaki Community Herbal Apothecary in so-called Maine is working to support their tribal communities during these COVID-19 outbreaks. They're asking for herbal medicine and medicine-making supplies or monetary donations to support their efforts. The supplies list can be found at their Fedbook page, which is listed in our show notes. And monetary donations can go to their fiscal sponsor, Why Hunger, which could be found at whyhunger.org/EWrematriation. You can contact livmoore16, that's livmoore16@gmail.com for coordination and more details. Lauren Reed is a 26-year-old Diné or Navajo man residing in the small town of Page, Arizona, who is facing 10 years for comments left on Fedbook during the nationwide protests because some dumbass white man with no scruples or sense of humor reported him to the cops. There's a breakdown of his case available at forgiveeveryone.com/blog. We're also linked in our show notes. At the end of that, you can find Lauren's address and tips for writing him, as well as how to put money on his commissary, how to make donations to Tucson Anti-Repression Crew, which is doing his legal support. You can do that via Cash App with $TucsonARC or on PayPal by finding prisoner support, noting for Lauren Reed in the comment. Here's a little bit about Santos Torres from Philly Anti-Repression on Twitter. As of last week, Santo Torres Olan, number ML7947, a comrade of Dwayne Statz of the Vaughn 17, is on a hunger strike at SCI Albion. He's protesting the physical, psychological, and emotional abuses at Albion. The prison administration uses meals, showers, rec, and mail as a form of punishment, retaliation, and psychological torture. His protest is against the prison system as a whole. Santos has also been charged with assaulting a guard, and the courts, public defender, and prosecutors are trying to railroad him. He ended up having to go pro se, or to defend himself legally, in order to fight his case. Help out Santos's struggle against the prison system by calling SCI Albion at 814-756-5778. Ask to speak to the superintendent and make sure they know that people on the outside are paying close attention to their torture and abuse of prisoners. Our incarcerated comrades are struggling against prison on a whole different level. We must support them from the outside when they ask us for help. Another announcement. Jay Chase, the last defendant of the 2012 NATO 3 conspiracy case, is finally fucking free. You can give money to his post-release fund in order to help get him on his feet by visiting GoFundMe.com and searching for Jay Case NATO 3. Welcome out, Jay. In more prison news, Jorge Cornell is a prisoner that has $2 and recently was moved to Fort Dix. Jorge has high blood pressure and sleep apnea. He is obese and borderline diabetic. This, along with a previous heart attack, make him high risk. Jorge is a friend of many in Central North Carolina organizing communities. As an outspoken community activist, candidate for city council, and police critic, Jorge was frequently targeted by law enforcement. Despite beating dozens of bogus charges prior to his current incarceration, Jorge is currently being wrongfully held thanks to overly broad RICO laws and targeting by the FBI, leading to a trial and conviction in 2012. He maintains his innocence, but still has 15 years left on an unjust 28-year-long sentence. If you want to learn more, you can hear two interviews from 2013 that we conducted by visiting our website and searching ALKQN. And we'll have more details in the show notes of how you can work to get a compassionate release for Jorge concerning his health. Finally, a regular listener, Jay, in Aotearoa, brought to our attention this week the passing of anarchist prisoner Brian Caswell McCarville in the so-called state of Oregon. Brian McCarville was a radical social prisoner who in the early 2000s was involved in taking the Oregon Department of Corrections to court, challenging their censorship and rejection of anarchist publications for prisoners with his cellmate Rob Thaxton, aka Rob Los Ricos. The ODOC was attempting to declare anarchists to be members of a security threat group, sort of like a gang, based on their shared political tendencies, the use of language and symbols, their stances of to protest unfair circumstances, etc. By winning the court case, he forced the Oregon prison system to allow anarchist materials into the prisons. Brian had terrible health problems, and following his victory in the court case, he was punished for a long time by authorities for taking that stand. He passed on his 68th birthday, September 27th, 2020, from causes unknown to us. Rise in power, Brian.
Hi, I'm Yusuf, and I use he or they pronouns, and I do some work with Heads Up in Durham.
And I'm Olive, and I use she and they pronouns, and I also do work with Heads Up in Durham.
So y'all have like written a fairly extensive handbook of your work and of sort of possible shapes that this kind of work can take, and like tips and tricks for organizing in other cities. And it starts off with a sort of a land back statement. Would you talk about land back, how land back relates to eviction defense and the work that you do with Heads Up?
First, we could start by reading the land acknowledgement from the handbook, and then maybe we can go into kind of more what it means. And we wrote this just, I know that sometimes land acknowledgements can be really superficial. They aren't really common too much in so-called United States. So we just tried to write one that we were doing our best, but I felt at the same time, like knowing that it's inadequate. So it goes like this.
We are grateful for the land, air, and water that sustain us. We're especially grateful for the rivers and creeks as places that offer an oasis for so many in this area. Grateful for the streams that form in the street when it rains as rivers guiding our steps. We acknowledge that settler colonialism is an ongoing process, and we hope that this acknowledgement can be a step in recognizing the continued colonization of this land and its people, and the inadequacy of calling this place, so-called Durham, North Carolina. As we reclaim this space here today, we acknowledge the violence that it took to colonize this land, to cultivate this land, to mine this land, to log this land, and to, quote, develop this land. We would like to acknowledge, to the best of our inadequate understandings, the Catawba, Okanichi, Eno, Tuscarora, Saponi, and Shikori peoples. This is native land, and white people in Durham occupy it as settlers and colonizers. We would also like to acknowledge indigenous resistance to the settler colonial state that motivates and inspires our actions. Just to name a few, encampments such as the Unistoten camp on unceded Wet'suwet'en territory, to rail blockades such as the Tiendanaga Mohawk territory camp in so-called Ontario, Canada, on unceded land, to the ongoing Kumeyaay and Tohono O'odham resistance to the border wall on the illegitimate USA-Mexico border.
Yeah, I love that. I love that y'all included that too, as a, you know, settler or invader on this land myself. Like, I've been very influenced by the work that's going on up there in so-called Canada with Indigenous defense and Indigenous sovereignty struggles. So, like, thanks y'all for including that and for being sensitive to this, the ongoing, like, violences of settler colonialism.
Yeah, I think that, like, when we talking about evictions and eviction defense on stolen land, I think that sort of challenging the culture that, like, enshrines this colonial concept of land ownership is an important part, like, a small but important part of a process of decolonizing, and that defending against evictions is part of work that creates a culture that recognizes housing as a human need and a human right, and that, like, draws attention to the fact that charging rent for stolen land is theft, on top of claiming ownership of stolen land. And I think that, like, doing eviction defenses sort of opens up and makes visible the fact that there are possibilities of and ways to relate to land and place and home outside of the way that we are sort of programmed to think about land and place and home by the colonial project of the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, as we, like, approach this work of eviction defense, and that's the word that we call it, but it's like kicking somebody out of their home, and how that, like, just relates to land and how people relate to the land that they're on and how they're disconnected from that are kind of all things that, you know, we keep in mind in this work, and how to break that isolation. And that's kind of something that we'll keep on coming back to and kind of why we're motivated to do this.
It's reminding me a little bit of, I had the opportunity to talk to somebody who was involved in the reclamation of a Sheraton hotel in Minneapolis, who was stating that a lot of, like, the folks who lived there were, like, formerly unhoused people, a lot of whom were Black and Indigenous, and folks who were Indigenous were stating that, like, having that hotel felt like getting their land back. And that's really what, like, resonated with me with the land acknowledgement at the beginning of the handbook that y'all wrote. Maybe before we get into anything more, like, nitty-gritty, would you just talk a little bit about Heads Up and how this group began in Durham?
Yeah. We began working together, like, in this form kind of right when the pandemic started. we came out of kind of pre-existing communities and networks of people with similar affinities who formed around like the international calls for rent strikes on April 1st and May 1st. Mm. And like this began kind of just as people talking of being like, hey, like COVID's happening, like what the fuck are we gonna do? And also a lot of people were losing their jobs and were worried about making rent or having to go into workplaces where it was just unsafe. And so like it began as an effort like focused around education and kind of just like through being on the internet, mm-hmm. which kind of at that time felt like one of the only things you could do. So we just had a social media, had a website, and we looked to projects in so-called Seattle, Richmond, and Austin as models early on for how to move forward. We were at that time, and our social media is still under this name, but at that time we were organizing under Can't Pay, Won't Pay. And we would often fall back on saying to ourselves as to like why we do this work and why it's so important. Kind of in that moment, it was like, if we can't pay alone, then let's not pay together. And that just felt really important as the idea of like a debt strike or a rent strike as something that, gave people power. So we started providing resources on like how to find out who owns your land, how to form like tenant associations in your building, and kind of just like some basics on tenant organizing. And that was mostly just like signal boosting like Autonomous Tenants Union in Chicago, LA Tenants Union, I think Philly Tenants Union, and Tank in the Bay Area. They all have excellent tenant organizing mm-hmm. guides, and like they were prepared and they were ready. And then kind of as the pandemic went on, we just developed a much deeper analysis, and we were building relationships with each other at the same time that kind of formed the basis for where we are today. And kind of as all of this was happening, we were also figuring out like how could we still be in the streets? How can we still like make some sort of confrontational presence around this? Because at that time, it felt like things did feel wholly more disconnected than they do now, even though that like COVID cases are, you know, in a lot of places much worse than they were back then. So we were organizing like car parades, which was like as a tactic, it was a really joyful procession through town. We stayed in the neighborhoods, like avoided the central business district and downtown, and people loved it. Mm. We had signs, we made noise, we did them on the weekends when people were out, people cheered, we blocked traffic. They were all really fun, and it was just kind of like cancel rent parade is what we were calling them. And probably one of the most heartwarming moments that I did want to share from that time, because it was something that we found really really endearing and really important, was that we heard from this person who's a teacher, and the teacher said that they had a student, and for show and tell, the student brought a video of a parade, and the teacher asked, what was it for? And the student responded, to cancel rent. And the teacher said, I wish I was there. And that really just like hit us in a way when we were like, oh, we could like maybe do something together that could affect others. And I guess as we're talking about like who Heads Up is and how we got to this place, the central part of it is the uprising. Mm-hmm. So kind of as things turned in like April became May and people were not making rent, but also there's not necessarily widespread like rent strikes happening. We definitely kind of entered a stage where we were like, okay, well, we're going to start working more directly with communities. We kind mm-hmm. of felt like more prepared at that point. And that kind of happened right as the uprising started. So there was a lot going on, but I feel like that's really when we began to take a turn towards kind of this thing that we've been just calling like trauma-informed organizing. And also we became much more geared towards abolition, and kind of the work started to affect us in a deeper way. And we can talk more on abolition later. But that kind of brings us up to the uprising. Heads Up eventually formed. We kind of have a thing going on where our social media is sort of different from our on-the-ground organizing presence, mm-hmm. and that's intentional. So much can get wrapped up in what like an Instagram account is or what a Twitter account is, and a lot of that can be so irrelevant to like the material needs of people. So that's kind of when we started focusing specifically on eviction defense, and we kind of changed our name to Heads Up, which stands for Housing Eviction Defense Solidarity. And we kind of, not necessarily formalized, but we started working together towards that one goal, which has resulted in the creation of this handbook, along with multiple eviction defense workshops in Durham, and kind of more stuff planned. We've also been working directly with tenants, just kind of like signal boosting phones apps that have been successful, and kind of using those kinds of pressure tactics. But a lot of this is it's like a learning process for us. And mm-hmm. It's like, how would we do an eviction defense? We have almost engaged in an eviction defense multiple times with people, but we've never actually gotten to that point yet. Mm-hmm. So part of this project is also how to, like, we ourselves get prepared for what we know is going to be necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially as winter is like rolling right on in. Yusuf, did you have anything you wanted to add to this topic?
I kind of was in and out throughout that evolution of Heads Up. And so, yeah, I think that Olive's perspective is really helpful in describing sort of like the continuity of that.
And there are definitely certain things that I want to touch on that you were talking about, Olive, later in the interview, but I would love to hear about the group's specific abolitionist orientation, and again, like how abolition relates to eviction defense in y'all's thinking and in y'all's praxis, or maybe not praxis for the radio, but just in y'all's thinking.
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about that, and I'll feel free to jump in. But I think that kind of sort of as the uprising started to gain steam towards the end of the spring, I think that we were forced to reckon with kind of a lot of different facets of the ways that abolition interacted with our work at the same time. And sort of, like Olive mentioned, sort of being forced to really center like community care and having and doing our organizing in a way that was trauma-informed, because like it was a traumatic time for mm-hmm. a lot of us, and also eviction is a traumatic event. And I think that like it became really important to us to look at how caring for each other mm-hmm. and making space for trauma and for the ways that mental illness shows up, and for being conscious of ableism around mental health, but obviously also all kinds of ableism in organizing and how that interacts with policing and the prison industrial complex, and sort of how caring for each other is something that is an absolute necessity, because the way that the state deals with trauma and with mental illness is carceral. And so that was one way that our work started to intersect more with abolition as the uprising started. But then also we wanted to move more towards doing work that was more directly confrontational to the police and the state, and you know, the way that sheriffs and police enforce evictions and sort of protect property and land holdings. Mm-hmm. And so we moved more from just informing and spreading information about what sort of rights are legally protected and when those rights expire and how to track evictions happening and how to sort of understand the court processes around eviction, and to focus more on how people can directly resist evictions. Mm-hmm. Olive and others led a workshop as part of a series happening in Durham called Abolish and Reclaim, a workshop specifically around eviction defense. And so most recently we've been doing a lot more directly working with tenants to confront their landlords. We recently boosted a phone zap that a tenant put together to pressure her landlord because he was attempting an illegal eviction and was refusing to accept rent relief. and that phone zap was thankfully successful. And that, along with us moving towards also doing court support and showing up at eviction court in solidarity with folks facing evictions and to offer sort of materials and information about folks' legal and other recourses when dealing with eviction has sort of characterized the shift that we are kind of undergoing right now as a result of the ways that the uprising has really forced us to more deeply integrate abolition into the ways that we think and do things.
Yeah, that sounds very inspiring. And also, I really like the sort of when you were talking, Yusuf, you know, the patterns of trying to sort of instill a community care model and how sort of lacking our general society is in doing community care, because I feel like neoliberalism really like wants everybody to be this kind of island and to not really like accept community care in a divide and conquer kind of way. And the way that like abolition and eviction defense is community care work is, you know, those strains run so deep. I would really love to hear more about the trauma-informed organizing. That is like somehow a phrase that I have not heard, but it really resonates with me, especially like in these times. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that, just like what that is and what that looks like for y'all.
Yeah, trauma-informed organizing, that is just something that we were kind of saying amongst ourselves as kind of a way to, I guess, like better approach organizing. And one thing that maybe we can touch on is just kind of the violence of nonprofits. And like many of us are like ex-nonprofit people that at one time or another were involved, and it was a harmful experience. And I think that a lot of, like, just, I guess just to speak for myself, not wanting to replicate these harmful systems is something that I take really seriously when I engage in, like, this kind of work, like, not wanting to replicate harm that's already been caused. So kind of just being like, we're going to start organizing, or we're going to organize, or community organizing, to me just comes off as like, oh, that is going to hurt some people, whether it's the employees or whether it's maybe the people that you're like, quote, organizing. There's the potential for harm. So that's kind of one part of it, kind of where I think where we, like, through our personal experiences have it, but also just working directly with tenants and hearing about how harmful eviction is and where people are at and hearing their stories, which is a lot of kind of what, like, this thing that people call organizing is. Like, it's really building relationships with others and building relationships of trust that can, you know, hopefully build in relationships of solidarity where you know you'll have people and people will know that they have you. So we were trying, like, with kind of this whole trauma-informed organizing thing that we say amongst ourselves, it's trying to be aware of what circumstances people are in and also be aware of our own circumstances, like, where are we at? And being deeply involved in all of this kind of work can also be really harmful. Like, there's, you know, all sorts of like burnout and other harmful patterns that can emerge in this work. And it was actually on an interview, on a Final Straw interview, the one about legal repression, or the panel that was recently, and somebody, I think, I forgot who it was, but somebody said this thing about sort of working when you're feeling really manic, and that really resonated with me when I heard those words. And it just kind of hit me, and it's just like, yeah, like, this started out definitely as a project, like, in reaction to the circumstances, because we were also scared about losing our places that we were going to live. So, you know, working from that to where, like, maybe, oh, we have a sense of security now, like, we might have figured it out, but others might not. Others might still be in crisis. So trying to do this work and approach it in a way that you're not just going to cause harm by treating people as a thing to be organized or like a number for the base building effort, but really try and make it so people who you're working with are as much a part of a process as you, and you're providing a sense of solidarity that is built in like trust and knowing one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so much of it is really, and also as a disclaimer, I think that like trauma-informed organizing is a thing that we say amongst ourselves is definitely like an aspirational thing and not a thing that I don't think that anybody has figured out yet. But I think that like a lot of it is really just about genuine and like honest relationships, and just like I think that so like I have a lot of experience and like a lot of traumatizing experience as a former, specifically a like quote unquote movement nonprofit worker, and I think a lot of like the violence that I saw happen in sort of this name, in the name of like base building. And I think that like for me, like I get antsy when I hear that language, and I like to talk about community building, because I think that a lot of times when organizing work that's geared towards like we have to like activate this base of people involves a lot of like kind of disingenuous and insincere relationship building, where like people who are like organizers go and act like they want to like be somebody's friend and like be in their life and care about them, when they are only caring about this person in a very conditional way because of the particular circumstance that they're in, or like in sort of like union organizing context, like because of the job that they have, and like when somebody leaves that job, or in a like so that like these relationships end and aren't, they're not genuine. And I don't think that when I think about community building, I don't think that necessarily means that you have to like be somebody's like ride or die friend all the time, but it does involve just being honest and real and interacting with people as a person, and offering what you can sincerely offer, and engaging with folks in a way that is honest. And I think also another big part of it is dealing with moments when our friends or community members or folks that we're interacting with are like dealing with mental illness and traumatic circumstances in ways that aren't always cute, and holding that and sitting with and doing the work of unpacking all of the like really carceral stigmas around mental health, and finding ways to like show up for people in those moments outside of the ways that we've been trained to, which are like usually either to ignore or turn away from things that make us uncomfortable, or to like want to outsource the care of people to in this like carceral way. Yeah, I think that work of sort of like unpacking internalized ableism stuff is a really important part of that.
Definitely. Yeah, thanks y'all both so much for going into that. I was, you know, really struck by when you said trauma-informed organizing, because it seems to me like a provocation, because I think that for as like versed as anarchists are in a trauma language, like we have a fairly developed and nuanced, in my opinion, like way that we talk about trauma, but in organizing it is still sort of, you know, viewed as something to avoid, something to like don't make a decision based in trauma because that's not like a real decision. And in a way that is, you know, showing a little bit of bigotry, or showing a little bit of fear, or, you know, not really acknowledging that trauma really has like a very systemic effect on somebody's whole being, you know. And so I really love that it, to me, like that the phrase just seems to center that, and I in a way that I think is really helpful. So I think like thank you both so much for introducing me and us to that phrase, because that's something I'm going to be thinking about for a long time.
Yeah, and I guess just the last small bit on that phrase is, as important as all of those other things are that we've been talking about, it's also about dealing with harm internally. Mm-hmm. That just kind of will inevitably come up when you're working with other people. So that's kind of also another part of it. And if we're going to be talking about abolition and a world without police, a world without prisons, a world without bosses or landlords and all of these things, then we need to be prepared for what that actually means. So in the sense, I like the idea of it as a provocation, because it's also, I also want to acknowledge it's a provocation towards that.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you for that. This is The Final Straw Radio. I am your host, William Goodenough. And this week you're listening to Olive and Yusuf, who are two organizers in Durham, North Carolina, talk about the Eviction Defense Platform Heads Up, which stands for Housing Eviction Defense Solidarity. So we have been talking about evictions. I am wondering if y'all would be willing to sort of sketch a portrait of how you've seen evictions usually proceed for anyone who isn't really familiar, and how Heads Up or another similar formation could like plug into that process.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I'll be saying is specific to North Carolina, mm-hmm. but the eviction process, while it's not the same everywhere, it often has similar steps. So obviously, like, research what the eviction process is like where you live. And when, like, talking about the eviction process, there's multiple ways that people can be evicted. The most common one that we focused on, and this is sort of like a shortcoming, but also a place to look for other things that are happening. So we're mostly focusing on if you miss rent. Mm-hmm. But it's important to acknowledge there's many other ways that people can be legally evicted, including criminalization, which is very common. Getting, like, calling the cops on people and getting them arrested, or having the cops come and that being reason to evict somebody. And also, when we're talking about evictions right here, first, kind of, there'll be the legal process, and there's an illegal process of eviction, or lawful and unlawful. I guess I think I like that language a little bit better. Mm. So for, like, the lawful eviction process, let's just say something happens, so we'll just say the tenant misses rent. The tenant has 5 days to pay rent, which is until the 5th. And then at that point, the landlord can provide the tenant with a 10-day notice. And after that 10-day notice to pay rent, the landlord can file what's called a summary ejectment, which is the paperwork that the landlord files in the county clerk's office to start the lawful eviction process. And one thing to note about, like, all this paperwork stuff is the landlord pays a little bit of money to do that, because you pay the clerks to evict somebody, and then the landlords, they get this money back in the settlement. So I guess it's also important to acknowledge when somebody's being evicted, they're also having to pay for the whole process of them being evicted, which is, like, something we see very commonly in the prison system as well.
Mm-hmm.
So once the summary ejectment is filed by the landlord, it's received and processed by the county clerk's office, and at that point a hearing is scheduled. So when we first started this off, the courts were closed for a while. They were closed, I think it was either into early June, and then in North Carolina there was another order to stop, like, have an eviction moratorium until the end of, like, June 21st or something. So after June 21st, that's when the eviction courts kind of started to open up again. So when COVID started, there was a big delay in the process, which is one of the reasons why so many people jumped to eviction defense work right away, because mm-hmm. it's kind of like a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Like, the courts stopped. It's, like, completely unprecedented. So it was an opening, and that's one thing to acknowledge. So once the clerk schedules the hearing, the sheriff receives it and delivers it to the tenant, which is often just posting it on the door if they can't get a hold of you. But by posting it on the door, that's delivering the summons that you have to go to court. And that's the first point that the sheriff can get involved. After that, the tenant will go to a court hearing. After the court hearing, the magistrate makes a decision. It's kind of once the tenant receives the summary ejectment, that would be the point for them to get a lawyer or contact legal aid to try to get representation. In North Carolina, or at least maybe this is in Durham specifically, there's, I think, only about 10% of tenants have representation in court, which is incredibly low. And one way that we've seen that's kind of been how the like progressive establishment responds to the eviction crisis is the city throwing more money at legal aid so people have representation, along with there being like law clinics at universities in town that also help provide people for representation in that process. And like while representation is of course like important, it's not even like a band-aid, because most every decision the magistrate makes is in favor of the landlord. And only if you get a lawyer do you probably have a chance to maybe not have a judgment against you. So after the magistrate's decision, there's a 10-day appeal period. If you don't appeal and the magistrate rules in favor of the landlord, a writ of possession is issued. A writ of possession is like the legal document that kicks you out of your house, to put it in like loose terms. It's the thing that once the landlord serves it, that's the moment when they can padlock what is your home, and then all of a sudden you're trespassing on somebody's private property if you're still there after that writ of possession is served. And it's also important to acknowledge that the only way the lawful eviction process works is through the courts. Like, the sheriff has to be involved and the courts have to be involved. Under no circumstances can a landlord evict you from your house. That would be unlawful eviction, or sometimes called like a self-help eviction. So if you appeal at that 10-day judgment period, it is sent to district court, and this is advantageous because it delays the process. And when the process is delayed, like, you still need to be paying rent, but there's ways to file motions in the court to where, like, if you don't have money, you don't have money, and there's like a legal term for that I forget, but it basically means you don't have to pay. So if you appeal it and it gets sent to district court, you at least can delay the process a little longer. And when we've talked to like tenant lawyers, they are often like, that's the best option, which to us is just like inadequate, like doesn't even describe that. Like, yes, a delay would be nice, but it doesn't actually like solve the issue at hand. So it's really rare that a tenant has a successful appeal. And if they have an unsuccessful appeal after they're here in district court and they get sent back, the writ of possession will be issued and the sheriff will serve it and the tenant would be locked out of their house. So there's multiple places to intervene in this. And in our handbook, we kind of are going to keep on releasing new versions of our handbook, and we're going to make the handbook much more public in the next few weeks. But one of the ways that we intervene through like our work is through court support, and that would kind of be during the court hearing. That would be when people are coming into court, we're at court, like we're set up outside with information, and we're talking to people, we're inside with information, we're talking to people at eviction court, and we're handing them the CDC declaration. So the CDC declaration is this, I don't know what it's like, a legal document put out by the Centers for Disease Control that basically stops the eviction process until December 31st, January 1st, but the tenant still owes back rent, but it does stop the eviction process. So that is kind of like the most important intervention people can do now by showing up to court and talking to people who are facing eviction, is making sure they have that CDC declaration and know how to like make it a legally binding thing, which is basically you have a copy, you sign it, you have a copy, you sign it, and you give it to your landlord. And then that should legally like stop the process of eviction.
Unfortunately, only works to stop the eviction process if the reason for eviction that the landlord names is failure to pay rent.
Yeah, that's totally true. And it's like a COVID thing, so by signing the declaration, you are signing like a legal document, and you're saying that because of COVID, like you can't pay your rent, and that is why the landlord is trying to evict you. So yeah, thank you for mentioning that. So I guess the other part is the unlawful eviction process. That can happen sort of at any time, but usually tenants kind of have some sort of heads up that their landlord is trying to illegally evict them. Sometimes the landlord will tell them, or sometimes maybe they'll know that something is up. And unlawful evictions can take the form of like retaliation, harassment, abuse of landlords to tenants, just kind of forcing somebody out of their home. Like we've heard stories of landlords like drilling people's deadbolts out as like a way to get them out, like not making repairs, like all the shitty things that landlords do to try to get you out of your house. That's like also part of the unlawful eviction process, which is a common way that people are kicked out of their homes.
It's such a, like, you know, like with anything associated with a court, such a weird, long, complex procedure. And I think that they probably like it that way, just because it's harder to interface with, given those circumstances. But thank you for breaking down a, like, kind of opaque process. I think it's good for people to understand, like, what all is involved.
Yeah, and I guess the little thing I'll add is, like, there's multiple interventions that you can make, and, like, one thing I will sort of note is, like, sort of like tenant union organizing and people organizing buildings, like, provides an opportunity to, like, get in relationship with people and just, like, before they miss rent or when they just miss rent. So I also just also wanted to acknowledge that, like, that work is also really important. We don't directly engage in, like, organizing buildings or whatever, but that's an intervention. And then the intervention of eviction defense would happen in, like, the final step when the sheriff comes to issue the writ of possession and lock the person, like, padlock the person out of their home.
Kind of on that tip, one of the questions that I had is the ways in which eviction defense is paramount to healthy tenant organizing. Would y'all care to speak a bit more on that?
Yeah, I think one thing that we kind of talk about amongst ourselves is, I guess we're not too connected to, like, oh, we're doing tenant organizing. I feel like we're more connected to, like, we're doing community defense, because it's great to have an organized building, but once you're out of that building, you might still, like, have people, but you don't have those same people who you were organizing with who, like, might have had your back because they live next door or something. So I guess that, like, I would just say that, like, eviction defense is like paramount to, like, a strong community defense. And part of that is having, like, renters that are organized. And by that, meaning, like, in relationship with each other, supporting each other, like, fighting for each other and taking care of each other. And those are, like, more the aspirational things, but there's a lot of other things that harm also comes with that. So I think that's also why we focus so much on, like, abolition and eviction defense, is because we're not just trying to get a bunch of organized tenants or just try and do a thing where we're creating, like, very strong and resilient communities that can resist the forces of, like, racial capitalism and the state and the police.
Yeah. And that was something that I really loved when I read that, the version of the handbook that y'all forwarded to me, was the sort of very intentional, very explicitly laid out position of, like, this is information. We're not, like, offering a service. We're, like, offering information. You know, it was really, I was really favorably impressed by that. One thing that you also talk about or touch on in the handbook a little bit, you intentionally don't really talk about, like, mechanisms of displacement and, or, you know, gentrification, just due to the lack of time and space, because, you know, those things really could fill books. But would you care to elaborate on that topic here a little bit in relation to sort of the kinds of things you've been seeing and experiencing, and what sorts of, like, patterns of displacement is Heads Up aware of and sensitive to?
Yeah, I think that gentrification and displacement are such an enormous force in Durham that's behind evictions and also behind policing of all kinds. in like really complex ways, it really could fill books. Mm-hmm. But I think that the ways that gentrification and sort of the introduction of like new luxury and expensive housing developments in Durham has like really, really directly resulted in escalated displacement and police violence in Durham in a really alarming way for many, many years. Mm-hmm. I sort of grew up in Durham, and so seeing the ways that gentrification is escalating and like really snowballing over time is really something. I think also like because of the ways that gentrification and like wealthy white folks moving in to neighborhoods, and specifically like Durham as a place that has this like or had this mm-hmm. reputation as a black city with a lot of like gun violence, has really shown up in more policing. And I think that like in 2018 there was the struggle between a homeless encampment that was across the street from this new condo development that it had been built, I think, the year before, but 2018, I think, was the year when, like, people had, like, moved in and it was, like, largely occupied, this, like, new condo development. And directly as a result of, like, lots of calls from that condo development, that encampment was raided and destroyed by the city of Durham and by the police. And so it's caused a lot of, like, not only landlord-tenant eviction-type processes, mm-hmm. but also a, like, general criminalization and heightened criminalization of homelessness, and also, like, these other forms of eviction or of, like, forcing people out of the places where they are living outside of even having a formal home.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also, as we look at the eviction court dockets, the realty companies and landlords that are, like, filling these dockets are the ones that are flipping houses, that do things like neglecting housing units just for the purpose of displacing tenants so that those units can be flipped. And, yeah, I'm sure that Olive has more to add on this topic as well.
Yeah, Durham is such a cesspool for this stuff. It's like gay cops, gay landlords, like fuck them all. Just because like Durham is such like a progressive gay city or whatever, that it's just like these same people do like such horrible things, while at the same time white gay people especially use their identity but also wealth just to dominate the city. And I think that, like, about gentrification, like, people have been talking about this for years now, and I just think one important part of our analysis is that, and in Durham this is especially true, displacement, and this kind of relates back to some of the, like, the first question, it's kind of always the perennial issue. Like, land has always been something that the state or colonial force or the police or like capital has been trying to push people off of and take from people and make sure it's scarce and make sure it's unavailable and make sure it's violent. So, you know, when we see like another new restaurant downtown or like another new condo, we know it's the same as when they raised the Haiti to build an interstate. We know it's the same when they built the new police precinct on the east side of town. We know it's the same when there was probably the same realty companies that still exist now doing redlining.
Welcome back to CKUT. I'm Brian. You were just listening to The Final Straw Radio. You can find more about the episode at thefinalstrawradio.libsyn.com.
There is this thing going on.
What?
You realize
our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
This hour was produced by the news collective that includes Grace Cobbold, me, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788. Or newsintern at ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at CKUT News. or connect with on Facebook, search at Off the Hour. We'll be right back next week with news from your area, and stay tuned to CKUT for Cafe coming up next.
L'Assemblée générale annuelle 2020 de CKUT s'approche à grands pas. Cette année, nous la ferons en ligne. Soyez des nôtres lundi le 23 novembre à 18h pour une soirée animée où vous pourrez apprendre comment nous avons adapté nos services et notre mise en onde pour répondre aux nouveaux besoins qui ont surgi dans le contexte de la pandémie. Il y aura aussi des comités à joindre. Si vous êtes intéressé à vous impliquer dans le conseil d'administration, écrivez à culture@commercialcKUT.ca pour plus d'informations. Merci de confirmer votre participation par courriel à agm@commercialcKUT.ca. En raison de pandémie, CKUT a décidé de rapporter indéfiniment notre campagne de financement annuelle. Mais nous apprécions toujours les dons pour soutenir nos opérations durant la fermeture. Le moment présent exige des nouvelles approches créatives, et des douzaines d'animateurs et animatrices ont relevé le défi en maîtrisant les logiciels pour vous livrer les émissions de très haute qualité. Nous sommes conscientes que CKUT 90.3 FM vous tient à cœur. C'est pour cette raison que nous faisons appel à votre générosité. Si votre situation vous le permet, nous vous invitons de vous rendre sur